Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe, today, and I'm glad you're with us. As you, a lot of you know, we do this program every day, probably every week, and Chris Kington Barker and I alternate weeks, and I have the pleasure of being with you today. Our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community, and Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-range ramifications of change or lack of change in our society. And we're glad you're with us today. I want to remind you that this is Public Radio KCBX, and we appreciate the fact that KCBX is a co-sponsor of the program and allows us to have the time to be with you today. Today we get to talk about a topic that I put in the category of an awful lot of people have heard of the organization and an awful lot of folks don't really know quite what they do. We're going to talk today about CASA. CASA is the Advocates for Our Children. It's court-appointed special advocates. Children are our most prized jewel, as we know, and for most of us, the care and nurturing of the children as they grow up is a key factor in how our children thrive and get through their childhood. And for many children, their family life and upbringing is not exactly what they expected it to be or what we as a society expect it to be. And so often when this happens, there's no way for someone in the family to really look out for a child under some special circumstances. CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates, as I said, is a key resource that we have on the Central Coast. We have actually all over the country. Each county, as best I can tell, has their own program. San Luis Obispo County has a program. Santa Barbara County has a program. Monterey County has a program. And today I have with me Kathy Orton, who is the Resource Development Director for CASA of San Luis Obispo County, and Pete Scarba. And he is the lead advocate supervisor. And both of them are here today to talk about the nature of CASA and the background of CASA and what it does. Because even though I've known people who've been volunteers with it before and I've paid attention to it a lot for the years, I still am really not clear exactly what they do and how they do it. So today, hopefully, we're going to find out. I appreciate you being part of the program today and I appreciate having these folks as guests with us today. I guess, Kathy or Pete, who has the longest history with the organization that can give me some history on this and tell me what CASA is all about?
Actually, that would be me.
Okay, go ahead.
I've been with the organization since 1994. I started as a volunteer myself that year. I took a case, which means I was an advocate for two little girls. That case lasted 2 years, and I have since become a staff member with the organization, and I not only work on outreach and public relations, but also I train the new volunteers. So the organization here in San Luis Obispo County has been here since 1993. Nationwide, the CASA organization started in Seattle when a judge noticed that he was, I think, pretty stressed out because he had to make life-altering decisions for these children who had been abused and neglected. He had to decide, would they go home to their parents? Was that going to be safe and nurturing, or would they get adopted? He had a very fast-moving court calendar, not much time to make the decision, and he had one report in general, and that would be from the social worker. Social workers, by law, have to go out once a month, and sometimes that was the only contact a responsible party was having with the family and the children. And based on the report the social worker would give him, he'd have to make these decisions. So he thought, there's got to be a better way. I need more information. There must be a better way to gather this information. So he started the CASA program with the idea that community volunteers can be trained and put in a place where they can interact with the children regularly, gather information about the children, and then also submit a report to the court. So that's where the program started nationwide. In our county, the grand jury began talking about the need for a CASA program back in the mid-'80s.
So let's try and sort out what you're actually advocating for. You're not the child's lawyer.
No.
You're not the child's social worker. And you're not the child's parent. So what specific role are you most likely to – where as the wheel turns and all the gears are there, where do you drop in this continued turning wheel with a child? Are you making sure the court treats them fairly? Are you making sure the child doesn't feel threatened or uncomfortable in the process?
Well, I guess you could say both, but really our guiding principle is what is in the best interest of the child, and that is what our volunteer is always looking at. I feel like the other people you mentioned certainly want what's in the best interest of the child too, but we're in the unique position of being a volunteer, of going out usually weekly to meet with the child and spend time with the child, accessing all kinds of confidential information such as school records, medical records, gathering all that to give that to the judge, and also to give our recommendation based on what we've uncovered in our research.
Mm-hmm. Pete, yeah, let me jump in with, I realize you have some more you want to add directly to that, but as it occurred to me, maybe if we can, in some part of your answer, walk us through the process of when a child first becomes aware that the child needs an advocate, and then how you enter the process. There's an entrance interview process, I suspect, of some type, and I'm kind of curious how that plays out.
Sure, there definitely is. Very often the families of the children that we work with have been known to law enforcement, been known to the Department of Social Services as being families in need for quite a long time before the child actually comes into under the jurisdiction of the court. The department, the social workers, hope to be able to work with the family enough to keep them from having to become a dependent of the court. In other words, be under the jurisdiction of the court. And when that doesn't happen, then they will ask the judge, they will ask the court if there is enough evidence to make this child a dependent of the court. A lot of people use the word ward. Ward is a different term. It's used for typically for probation. A dependent is a child that is under the jurisdiction of the court for no fault of their own, for abuse or neglect by their caregiver. The power in this position, the power of a CASA position, is that we are sworn officers of the court, and therefore we have the ability to read everything that the court reads, everything that the attorneys get, all the information, the evidence that comes from the department, comes from any source that generates information on the child. The CASA advocate can have that information too and use that information in deciding what is in the best interest of the child. To kind of expand on your initial question, definitely our advocates can look at what's happening in this child's life and make suggestions in all aspects of the child's life, anything that has related to school, anything related to health, mental health issues, anything that's related to what the department is doing, the services that are provided for the children, or even services that the children need in addition to what's being provided, we can make suggestions and recommendations on those things.
We're talking today with two folks from CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates, and it's a topic that a lot of people in an organization, a lot of people know about, but a lot of us don't understand what the roles are that are carried out by CASA, so it's good to be able to talk about this. So the court calls CASA, or someone from the court calls CASA and say that we have a new child a child entering the legal system for some reason. We would assume more often than not that's because of some abuse. I suspect there are cases where it's not that the child is abused. Maybe someone involved in the court process or in the law enforcement has discovered that the parents that are involved with the child are not giving the child what they need. So I'm wondering what the kinds of cases, other than the child, just direct child abuse, you're called in to specifically deal with.
There are a limited number of check boxes, essentially, or reasons that the court can take the jurisdiction in a case. And the one that is most predominant is general neglect. So probably 70 to 80% of the cases come in on general neglect, which means that the caregiver has not provided enough food or shelter or medical attention or anything that's important in a child's life, and the child is not safe living in that condition. The reason that children normally get neglected, the biggest factor is drugs and alcohol and mental health issues on the parents' part. Less frequently do the children come in for physical abuse or sexual abuse or other reasons that the court can check in order to get the children into jurisdiction. So general neglect is the number one factor for this.
So with general neglect, we would generally think that that child would be moved into a foster care type environment. What would the court or the CASA volunteer on the case still need to address? Let me be somewhat flip about it, and I apologize, but give you kind of a reverse scenario on that for the moment. If there's a concern about the child, it's real clear that the child can't stay with parent X. So it's decided through Child Protective Services or some other organization that they need to put this child in foster care. They need to basically remove either temporarily or permanently custodial rights or parental rights from a parent. That may be a process that's carried out by the court in a very brief period of time, and the child is moved into a foster environment. And that's good. I wonder what CASA would be needed for in a situation like that, because the recurring theme I've heard about CASA, and I've heard it from some of your comments here, and especially how CASA as a national program started, would seem that a lot of it may be in the category of it's really obvious what's going on with this child and it's obvious what's going on in this household, so we just put them in foster care and the issue's over as far as the court being part of the process.
You know,
and I'm not trying to challenge you on whether or not what you do is valuable, because I know what you do is valuable. I'm trying to figure out kind of what circumstances under which the stepping in is really that critical.
You know, and as soon as the child comes to the attention of the court, like I said, there could be a long history with this family of interventions or services trying to keep the family together to take care of the parents' drug issues or alcohol issues or mental health issues. And when it fails and it comes to the point where the child is no longer safe, then the department has to step in, remove the child, ask the court if there's enough evidence on this. At that point, you're right, it goes into foster care, and yet there is a whole process that has to go forward from here that could take a year or longer in order for the parents to get the services they need to reunify with this child. During that time, the child is out of home. Is the day that the child is removed from their parents, no matter what, how hard it is or how difficult it is or how much neglect they've suffered or even abuse they've suffered, the child's traumatized by removing from their parent.
Understood, yeah.
It is extremely traumatizing for the child. And in addition, they have all the trauma that's gone on before in the home with the parents. So there is a lot of needs and a lot of issues that these kids have that our advocates can pay attention to in a much more direct and direct way than anybody else in the system can. As Kathy mentioned, the social worker has a mandate to see the child once a month, and we have excellent social workers in this county, in my opinion. We have people that really care about kids. When I sit down at a table for a meeting, there might be 15 or 20 people at the table, and I can tell you that I believe everybody at that table cares about kids as much as I do, and it feels great to work with a team like that. But everybody's got their own idea, their own agenda when they come to the table. CASA is the only one whose agenda is strictly the children. The social worker has a mandate to try and reunify the family if that's possible. CASA doesn't have a mandate to reunify the family. CASA has a mandate to make sure this child gets what he or she needs while they're in the system. So it could be medical issues that nobody was aware of, or mental health issues that weren't being addressed or nobody was aware of. You know, one way to look at it is that we make sure that these kids don't slip through the cracks. And certainly that sometimes happens in a system this big, that a kid can get overlooked for various things. When there is one adult that is paying nothing but paying attention to this one child or sibling group, it's far less likely for them to fall through the cracks, and that's the strength of our program.
Okay.
And I'm just going to add for everyone to keep in mind, foster care is a temporary solution, and children aren't put there with the intent that they will stay there. The hope is always reunification with the family. Research shows that is the best thing we can do for children, if that family can be made into a safe, permanent, loving home. So foster care is really the beginning of a process where we've yet to figure out what will be best for this child. Can these parents become safe and nurturing again? And that can take a very long time, really. If they need treatment for alcohol or drug addiction, a year is really nothing if you ask a therapist involved with these problems. And we're asking them to do it in a year, and in 6 months if their children are under the age of three. So they have a lot to work on. These are their children by right. They have a right to raise their own children. So foster care is temporary. Once kids get into foster care, it's not unusual that they move frequently while a decision is made about whether they'll ever return home. So it's a process that just starts at that beginning point of being removed from the parents in a very traumatic way and beginning this process of going through foster care and hopefully reuniting, but perhaps also staying in foster care for years or going into a guardianship or adoption.
Okay. So if maybe a strange hypothetical, but let me use it as a hypothetical. You have two scenarios for a given child, and the issue may be, among other things, drug abuse in the household. So you may have a child that's old enough, 10 or 11 years old, to basically to become a self-advocate in some regards, if they're a pretty savvy child. That child may have a view that if you can help, or if the court can help find a way to clean my parents' drug abuse up, I want to be back with that parent as soon as I can because I care about them and we have a good relationship except for the drug abuse. You may have a child in the same situation at the same age, the scenario the same on every regard, that might say to you or say to the court in some way, I feel so threatened and so hassled by the years and years of drug abuse in my household that I don't know that I'm ever going to trust my parent again, even if they become clean and sober for a decade. So in the court system, if you're dealing with the lawyer for the parent, other legal people, they may have a different view as to what they need to advocate for. From what you're saying is your job is to just make sure that child's wishes and needs get heard or paid attention to, so some 11-year-old doesn't have to argue with a lawyer across the table. Do you handle both of those situations differently? And how do you get a working relationship with the child to really understand what the child needs? Because the child may be telling you what they work around their fears with, but not what they really want as an outcome. And I don't know how you sort that out. And that may have been a more complicated scenario than you'd like to work with.
I think that's really common. Both of those scenarios are really common, and our advocates face those in every one of the cases that we work on. The child's going to have an opinion of whether they want to go home or not. Mostly the children want to go home. But sometimes when the children get older and they realize that, their parents may not get better, and if they do go home, if they do reunify, that it's probably going to be more of the same, only maybe a little bit better, that there's a place that they can go to, be supported in their educational goals that they wouldn't necessarily get at home. Sometimes those children will say that I'm not ready to go home. I don't want to go home. The CASA advocates can certainly speak for it. The child has an attorney in court. The attorney is also the voice of the child for the court. But nobody but the CASA advocate can spend the amount of time with the child that we do. The CASA advocate, we ask for them to spend once a week with the child. It ranges from an hour on up. Sometimes it's many hours a week, and the advocate gets to know the child really well, establishes a trust with them, and the child's often able to tell the CASA advocate things that they couldn't tell anybody else, including the social worker, including the foster parent. And unfortunately, they're not able to see their attorney typically, except when they go to court, and there's not very often a time for them to sit down with the attorney. But the person that is there for them week in and week out, month in and month out, through all the changes, is their CASA advocate. So that's the bond that we can establish in order to understand what the child needs.
How long are you usually involved in a case?
Well, I think the study we did showed 18 to 24 months is, mm-hmm. is pretty common, but it can be a lot less than that, and it can also be more. The supervisors often have a pretty good idea of how long it will probably take based on where the case is as far as the law is concerned about when certain decisions have to be made, when parental rights might be terminated. We can get involved in a case at any point in time.
Mm-hmm. And I got a little bit of a story about that, how long we can stay involved. One of my advocates, Doris, took her first case in 1999, or I think it was 1999 or 97. I don't remember. I'm sorry. She advocated for two siblings. She remained in touch. She is still in touch with the girl on that case after all these years. And the girl recently told her that she just graduated from the CASA program in another county and is going to be a CASA advocate in that county. So, you know, that's a lifelong commitment. That's something that you can't buy, and you can't get any other place except for people that care as much as the people that come and volunteer for this.
So you're appointed by the court. So the local judge dealing with a given circumstance is going to approach CASA and say, we'd like a CASA advocate assigned for this child. It occurred to me when you're dealing with lawyers, there's sometimes things are about butting heads. And I'm wondering, is it a difficult problem? Can some lawyer say, you know, the CASA volunteer doesn't – the CASA advocate is not not doing for this child what I as their lawyer want to see done. And at that point, how does that get addressed? Because I'm sorry to bring that up, but it occurred to me that you don't want an 11-year-old in the middle of that discussion. And sometimes that can be used against the child or the system. How do those kind of conflicts come up? Because my hunch is not all the time are all the people involved in this looking for the well-being of the child.
Well, I was just going to say it's not an adversarial court. People are working pretty much on the same page in the best interest of the child. And, of course, people have different opinions.
We full disclaimer here, I love all the attorneys in our courtroom. If you're listening, you know I love you. So, but it's true that the attorneys that we have, and it's a panel of attorneys because primarily the court will assign an attorney to the child and to each one of the parents individually, and typically nobody can afford an attorney in this court. So the judge assigns an attorney. The attorneys rotate through. So on this case, attorney X will have the mom. On the next case, she'll have the dad. On the third case, she'll have the child. So they don't key on one particular member of the family through all the cases. And we collaborate. We talk to each other. We make sure that everybody knows what's going on. We have a very close relationship with the department, with the social workers. And that's probably our number one strength is our ability to access the social worker. So on a friendly basis and not on an adversarial basis, we can go to the social worker and say, you know, I noticed these behaviors. And every time this happens, Johnny has this behavior. You know, what can we do about that? And we can work together with the social worker to create a program or create some kind of a service that's going to help the child through that. If the attorney has a different opinion than us, that's not atypical. That's certainly something that happens, especially and almost exclusively when it comes to time to send the child home. Is it time to send this child home? Is it safe to send this child home? And that's really a tough question for everybody because we'll never get the perfect parent. None of us have been perfect parents. So we'll never
talk to my children. They'll verify that I'm not a perfect parent.
You and me. Okay. And, so we're not going to create the perfect parent in this system, especially given, 12 or 18 months that we're going to have to work with this family. The question becomes, is it good enough? Is this child going to be safe enough? And everybody's – it's a very subjective question, and everybody's got a different answer on that. And ultimately, the court makes the decision. So in cases where opinions vary and you know, the parent's attorney says, yes, it's time to send the children home, the department and their attorney says, no, it's not time, or CASA says, no, it's not time, or the child's attorney says, no, it's not time, then there's a trial. And the judge will convene a trial. Evidence will be presented. Witnesses will be called. There can be cross-examination. There's not a jury. It's decided by the judge in the end because it's a very non-public court. Mm-hmm. And the judge will weigh the evidence and make the final decision. But it's – and that happens quite frequently. And, you know, because it is a very subjective question. Is this good enough for this child? And what's it going to look like going forward?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, and that's why we our advocates concentrate on one child or one sibling group only. The social worker may have, you know, 12 or 15 families they're working with. And when you say 12 or 15 families, that's a mom and a dad, X number of children, mm-hmm. aunts and yeah. uncles, grandparents, foster parents, and their plate is full. The attorneys have hundreds of clients. The judge has 501 kids in the system right now. Our advocates have one child or one sibling.
Is that a number that's somewhat consistent, or is that just a number? I mean, did you pick that number to emphasize how the magnitude, or indeed do we have about 501 kids in the system now?
When I looked in our database this morning, it was 501 children.
And when I started with CASA in 94, it was about 500 children. Oddly enough, this number doesn't vary a great deal. It has fallen down around to about maybe 450, maybe even a few less, but now we're back up there again to 500.
And a lot of it is, as time goes on, and Kathy had mentioned that the judge in Seattle, when he was looking at these cases, she mentioned that the social worker has a mandate to see the child once a month. But in those days, they didn't even have that mandate. There was no mandate to see the child once a month. Now we do. So laws have changed. Theory has changed. The approach to children in the system has changed. And the approach to working with families. So it's no longer just a knee-jerk reaction. If a parent's taking drugs, we take their children away. You can imagine we wouldn't have enough places to put kids if we took everybody that smoked pot on the weekend or drank too much one night. We wouldn't have a place to put all the children. So it has to reach a critical level before the children go into the system. And at that point, the parents can contest it. They can ask for a trial. They can call witnesses. They can ask for evidence to prove that they are a fit parent. Nobody disputes that the parents love their children and the children love their parents. It's the safety of the issue, the safety of the children that's the issue.
Yeah. I want to remind folks, this is Central Coast Voices if you're just joining us, and I have Kathy Orton, who's the Resource Development Director for CASA of San Luis Obispo County, and Pete Scarda.
Correct.
I'm sorry. It, you know, even though I pronounced it right, I think the first time, every time I look at it, I'm for some reason I don't do well with names, and I apologize. He's a lead advocate supervisor for court-appointed special advocates. That's CASA, and this is a fascinating topic. I believe it's a topic we wish we didn't have to address. I wish it's a need we didn't have to address. One of the things in some of the comments that you provided for us before the program is that there seems to be an underlying theme that people think this is a wonderful place to live, therefore there are no children who don't think it's a wonderful family to live in all the time and things like that. So I'm sure what you do sometimes, I suspect it falls on deaf ears. Oh, don't tell me we need to address this kind of problem. There really is not too much have a problem with this. Why are you doing it? Which brings me to the question I want to go with at this point. What motivates someone in your experience to become a volunteer with CASA? What gets them started in the process? I mean, jump in. Pete, you did mention earlier that you had a case of someone who was a CASA child advocating for, or a child that got advocated for by your program who is now becoming a CASA volunteer someplace else as an adult.
That's correct.
But that's probably not the everyday scenario. So what gets people involved in this?
Well, I think it's quite a lot of different reasons, but I think underlying, people get involved because they love children, and it really bothers them that some children are having such a rough go of it as children. We do attract a lot of teachers, especially retired teachers, nurses, people in kind of that background of caring professions, helping professions often come to us. But that said, we've had bartenders working with us, people from really all walks of life, and we really like that. But you have to love kids because that's who you're going to spend your time with. That's where you'll spend most of your time.
How many volunteers do you have in San Luis County?
Well, we have 114 actively working throughout the county right now. We've got a few on standby waiting to get matched up with a child or sibling group. We tend to serve about a third of the children in the county who need a CASA volunteer. Our judge, in general, requests a CASA volunteer for every case that comes into the system. It's very rare she'll say this one really doesn't need it. So we're basically getting all the cases that come into the system, and our supervisors triage those cases and look at them both for where's the biggest need, but then also they have to look and say, do we have a volunteer available that we could match with this child or sibling group.
Do all of your volunteers only handle one child at a time, or
child or sibling group? Occasionally, okay. We'll have somebody who perhaps takes on a new family when the old family's sort of almost taken care of. Maybe they're in a solid placement. A child maybe is going to be adopted soon. That person might start a new case. But in general, just one family or just one child.
So you could have a volunteer that for their entire volunteer term, if you will, may only work with one child or one family. The flip side would be you have some volunteers that will finish with a case and then step into another environment like that.
A lot of our CASA volunteers do take another case. They more typically take a bit of a break.
I'm sure.
Maybe a few months.
It's good that you that you commented that way, because one of the questions in the back of my mind is, have been involved in earlier parts of my life with some peer support groups. What kind of support system within CASA do you have to help your CASA volunteers cope with what's got to be, in a lot of cases, an incredibly stressful situation?
It really can be, and we'll both talk about it, I think. But I think we have an excellent program for that, the main thing being the supervisors such as Pete. Every volunteer is assigned a supervisor, and that supervisor is readily available to them to advise them, to counsel them, to help them through the process, and our supervisors are very resourceful and know where to turn for help. Our supervisors all give out their cell phone numbers, and in the event that you can't reach your supervisor, you'll probably reach another supervisor quite quickly. So we have that built in. We also have case discussion meetings on a regular basis where volunteers come together with a supervisor to talk about their cases and maybe brainstorm solutions.
And both Kathy and I volunteered before we came on staff. I worked on two different cases for about 4.5 years before I came on staff. And the one thing that struck me when I was volunteer was the amazing support that this office offered. And so when I was able to come on staff, I was happy to do it because I wanted to be a part of that team. It's a fantastic group of people. The support that I felt, I know our advocates feel, and I think that that's the number one thing. If we can tell people and show people that what they're doing really makes a difference, and it does, even in cases where people think, well, I didn't do a big hero thing like so-and-so did on her case, just being there for the child is the biggest and strongest thing we can do. Statistically or you know, clinically, the best thing that can happen for a child is that there is a caring, committed adult in their life. And when the child feels like somebody has their back, that somebody knows where they're going through all these changes, they're new social workers, sometimes several new social workers throughout their case, new houses, new foster homes, people that unfortunately reject them, even foster parents, even prospective adoptive parents say, I can no longer do this. You're going to have to take this child out of the house. There is one person that's going to be there for this child that they know they can count on, and that's without value. And so even if somebody doesn't go into court and make some great Perry Mason, you know, moment in court, what they have been able to do for the child is without value, it's an amazing thing. And if we can let people know the difference they make, it keeps them healthy. I think it keeps them, you know, going forward and understanding what they can do. Okay. No question, this is a very difficult volunteer position. It's not like anything else in the county. You know, we sometimes get likened to big brothers, big sisters, but and we do have an aspect of that. We do establish a relationship with the child. We can't take the child to our home, but we also can do something about a problem that we see in this child's life. We can take it to the social worker. We can ask for services from the social worker. And ultimately, if we don't get what we want from there, we can ultimately take it to the court and ask the judge if there can be some intervention in something in this. And when people feel like they're making a difference, it really helps them to keep on target.
Yeah, over the last 3 years that we've been doing this program, the radio program, Central Coast Voices, I've interviewed folks from Family Care Network. I've recently interviewed folks from Bikers Against Child Abuse, fascinating organization. Everybody has different roles in this process. Both those organizations do a wonderful job with what they do. It sounds like you have more of a standing in the court to basically be heard on behalf of the child. What does your interview process, if you can give me an idea, if you're sitting down with a child for the first time, who's in the room besides you? What kind of questions and dialogue do you develop with that child? Obviously, it may be a while before you get candid answers from a child that's feeling like either the system or their family is not a safe place to be. How do you start that process?
You know, that's a really good question, and just about every one of our advocates asks that question when they get started. How can I get started on this? What do I do, you know, when I go to meet this child for the first time? The thing to remember and that we try and remind them is, even though we're going to do an investigation, and we call it an investigation, we're investigating the circumstances in this child's life as they are. We're not investigating the circumstances that brought the child into the system. That's already been established. The court's already ruled on that. There's been enough evidence to support whatever happened to remove this child. So we don't have to ask the child, how many times were you hit, or how, you know, what happened in this particular case. That's not the information we're looking for. We're trying to get them to tell us what they want now, what they need now. And sometimes not even verbally. You know, if they can just go forward and we can watch in their life and see that they're struggling, for instance, in school, well, maybe we can ask the school for an assessment to see if there's a learning disability and the child needs an IEP in school. And we can work on that. And so the advocate, to start with the child, it's very simple, and I tell people, you know, go there, meet the foster family, meet the child, stay for 15 or 20 minutes and say, okay, I'll be back next week at this time, and we'll think of something fun to do. Or maybe we can go to the park, or maybe we can go out for, you know, a yogurt. And start slowly, start easily with the kids, move into it, and it's before long, the kids think they've known you for a long time, even though you may have only visited for 4 or 5 weeks. Mm-hmm.
So the relationship you're building, at what point does the court ask you for input about a child, and what kind of specific things is the court asking you to bring to the discussion that hasn't been there before?
That's a great question, because to me, that's where the rubber meets the road in our job. We essentially work for the judge. We are, you know, it's described as the eyes and ears of the court, and the judge will often say, I wish I could do what you do. I wish I could go to this child's home. I wish I could talk to the teacher. The judge can't do that. The only information the judge gets is the information that the social worker brings in her report, or the CASA advocate brings in her report, in their report. And if there's no CASA advocate on the case, then the judge is only getting the information from the social worker. So in the court process, there's a hearing at minimum of every 6 months. So there's a regular review hearing every 6 months. At each one of those hearings, the CASA advocate is going to present a written report to the court. We have a template. It's a pretty exhaustive report. We're going to report on mental health. We're going to report on physical health, educational issues, relationship issues, and give a conclusion and our recommendations. So if the child needs something, we have the avenue to let the judge know about that and why the child needs what we're asking for. So that happens every 6 months. As time goes along and the case comes to the end and there's no reunification, there's going to be a hearing that's going to determine what the permanent plan for this child is going to be. And the permanent solutions are adoption, guardianship, long-term foster care. Our advocates can also weigh in on that, too, and say what they think the best plan is for this child and why. And as time goes along after the permanency hearing, then again, every 6 months there's a hearing that the court's going to hear how the child is doing while they're either waiting for adoption, while they're in guardianship, or they're in long-term foster care. And we'll be able to weigh in on that, too, and let the court know.
Well, I was just going to add that even though we provide information in the form of a written court report to the judge, I don't like people to get overwhelmed with that idea because it's not the main thing they work on throughout this time. Their focus is on seeing the children and developing the relationship. And they get so much support with writing this court report that should never be something that keeps a volunteer from saying, I don't want to do this because I don't want to write that report. It's not that big of a deal.
Yeah. As you're presenting this, one of the things that comes to mind, too, is because it's a court situation and you have not only a lawyer who is the legal counsel for the child, which is good that that's appointed for them, but you may be dealing with a lawyer for a parent who you may be dealing with a parent who's not the best friend of the court or the situation. And you may be that lawyer, their lawyer's job is to advocate for their client. I'm not necessarily suggesting that the lawyer is not being fair, but that lawyer's role is to advocate for their client. Do you find that sometimes you as advocates and your volunteers as advocates end up with lawyers for parents that want to challenge what's being recommended by the CASA volunteer? And I guess what comes to mind for me is how do you keep the CASA volunteer safe from that being a an unhealthy or scary situation for them? As I'm saying that, it occurred to me, you may have a volunteer walk in someday and say, you know, I just got reamed pretty badly by a lawyer in court and I can't do this anymore. And that would be a concern of mine in that situation.
You know, it definitely, we don't agree. You know, there's going to be disagreements with one side or the other. And I think, as Kathy pointed out earlier, you know, we are really fortunate in this county to have a judge and a court that is not looking for adversity, not looking for a fight. We're in there together for the best interest of this child. And yes, the parent's attorney must and should advocate for the parents' wishes, which is to return the children almost exclusively. Let's return the children and let's do it as soon as possible. And yet the judge is going to be the final arbiter on, is it safe? Is it time? Is it ready? Based on the evidence that she gets. So it's never really a case where we're pitted against the attorney. We're just introducing evidence to the judge, giving essentially testimony to the judge that the judge will then base her rulings on. And I tell my advocates, you know, we have to go in there and play in the same sandbox with all these people again tomorrow. So, you know, it's not really in anybody's best interest to have a fight. And I've never found that there's been acrimonious feelings even after really contentious issues, because everybody realizes I'm doing my job, I'm doing it the best I can, and it's not a personal issue. We are doing, everybody there is doing the best they can for the kids and the families in the system.
So let me kind of synopsize back to you. So you're dealing locally, at least in San Luis Obispo County, you're dealing with a judge and a court system that is usually looking to make sure that the CASA advocate volunteer does not become the brunt of someone's legal battle.
No question. And their reports are vetted by their supervisor. So when somebody hands in a report to their supervisor, the supervisor goes over it and makes sure that it's fact-based, that we are quoting sources. So if we hear something from the foster parent or we hear something from the child, we're saying, you know, we're not stating it as fact. We're saying we heard this from the foster mom or we heard this from the child. And we're putting it in there on that basis. So we're not going in there saying, I know this and I know this to be a fact. We're saying this is what we heard from this person and this is what we understand. So it's a fact-based report, and we're there to vet that and make sure that it is. And then when we're done with the report, we hand it to one of our fellow supervisors who also goes over it and makes sure that there's – well, that grammar is correct, but that there's nothing in there that is going to be not fact-based.
Mm-hmm. So – It sounds like, and it's historically sounded like, an incredibly valuable program in the county. And from what Kathy, what you said a little while ago, a lot of your volunteers come from positions of maybe retirement from being more of an advocate for children sometime early in their life, being a teacher or something like that. What are some of the first questions that that potential volunteers ask you? And what are your kind questions, kind answers to some of those questions? Because I'm sure you get some real tough questions. Well, I want to get involved in this, but doggone it, explain to me why I'm not going to want to jump off a cliff after I do it.
Well, many concerns are brought our way, of course. But in the back of their minds, if they came to us, they're really pretty driven already to make a difference, to get involved, to help a child. One of the big concerns that comes up is, will I get too involved, too emotionally involved, and I can't get out of it, and I want to adopt the child, and I'm already 65, I already have three kids, and I'm 40, and I can't do that. Whatever it is, we reassure them that is not your role, and if you're even thinking about that, we'll refer you elsewhere. So that's a big concern. And then the supervisors work a lot on, we teach about boundaries, of course, and then the supervisors reinforce that as the volunteer starts to work their case, that your role in here is a temporary intervention for the child while they're in the system. Yes, some volunteers continue on in an informal way later, but not all. You're here temporarily. We have very strict guidelines by law about how involved we can get. And so the supervisors are really key to keeping the volunteers on track so they can keep their emotions in check. And the volunteers, too, can process that with their supervisors if they're feeling too emotionally overwhelmed. We'll step in and we'll help with that.
And what's involved in the training process?
Well, we do 30 hours of initial training. We do that in two different formats. We have some classes that meet in the day, 30 hours face-to-face, and then we have others that meet in the evening where half of the training is actually done online. So that's you're only spending 15 hours in class, 15 hours doing your online work. It's great for people who are comfortable with that, motivated to do the work online, and maybe don't have the time to do the face-to-face training. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just to add to that, the training that it is required to work, for instance, in a group home mm-hmm. is less than 30 hours. So you can work with a child directly in a group home and get less training than we provide for our advocates to go out. The background check for those employees is less than our background check. So people that come into this, and I think it's true, this is not a volunteer job for everybody. It's not like going to walk puppies on the weekend at Woods Humane Society. If you don't show up next week, the puppies don't know. They don't care. But if you don't show up for this child next week, that child's going to know, and the child's going to care. So we vet people very carefully, and we have an extensive interview process, and we ask pretty personal questions of this person to make sure that the people we let into our program are the people that should be with children, and we want to be with children, and children are going to want to be with.
Yeah, in a court system where there's a lot of privacy involved, does a potential volunteer, or where in the process do they get to take a look at what the process is? Because obviously you have a potential advocate that's in training or has some question about what their role will be in this. They may not have the legal ability to actually sit in a court case to see it because it's a private mm-hmm. court. It's not a public court like you would have for a
Correct.
Regular trial.
It is a confidential yeah. court, but part of our training program is that the volunteers in training go to court and they sit through one court session. So they get a look at that part of their job as well. What happens in court? What does that look like?
And they can sit in on their cases. So any case that they're assigned to, they can be in court for any aspect of that. So they're welcomed by the judge for the review hearings every 6 months for any trial that might come up. If there's a chambers conference, in other words, if the judge calls all the parties back into chambers to speak off record and try and make a decision, the CASA advocate is invited in for that so that they are – because they're actually a sworn officer of the court, and they can get all the information that any of the other court officers can get or any of the other people in the court – in the case can get, and they're able to weigh in on all of those things on their own particular case.
How do you address – and this is a tough one, but I know it's come up before, so I'm curious. How do you address parents in a case who are not happy with the recommendation from a CASA volunteer? Because the court – the lawyers in the court at least know court decorum. The judge knows court decorum, and your volunteer knows court decorum. But there may be parents involved in the process that are not quite clear on the court decorum.
It's a pretty rare case where parents would be able to interact with the CASA advocate in such a way. In court, I don't recall ever seeing a parent yell or scream or really become violent or aggressive against anybody, including the CASA. And ultimately, it's the judge that's making the decision. It's not the CASA that's making the decision. We give a recommendation to the CASA – or excuse me, to the court. The parents can read the CASA report, but ultimately, it's the judge that's making the decision. So all eyes are focused on the judge. And if something happens, it's the judge that's made the decision, not any other person in the court. And I think that parents understand that, and the parents see that.
And if the parent doesn't understand it, maybe their lawyer gives them a little advice and says,
absolutely,
you know, you're not helping yourself here by screaming at the CASA volunteer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's an indicator to all the parties, including the judge, that, you know, there's something still that needs to – this parent needs to work out.
Yeah. Yeah, Kathy, you mentioned that you guys have an event coming up in September, and you want to tell us a little bit about that? We only have a couple of minutes left.
Sure, so. I'd love to do that because we are a nonprofit, a 501c3 nonprofit, so one-fifth of our budget actually comes from this large event that we're having in September. We do this every year, and that is our rendezvous at the Country Club, September 17th. That's the San Luis Obispo Country Club. It's really a fun event. For anyone who's ever been, you'll remember the cake auction that we do. It's amazing. It's so much fun to watch, and everyone who participates or observes it has a great time. We have cakes donated from bakers all over the county, including Madonna Inn, Cassie's Custom Cakes, and June McPhee from McPhee's in Templeton, and we have fabulous auction items. This year we've got Doobie Brothers tickets for the Vina Robles event in October, and McPhee's donates a winemaker dinner, and we have Dave Hovde from KSBY as our MC. So it's a very lively, fun-filled evening. And
what's the website so people can get information about it further? We've tried to give out phone numbers before. It doesn't always work.
No,
but the website may help if possible.
The website's great. It's slocasa, slocasa.org. And you can get information about our events. You can get information about volunteering. You can download an application. It's pretty much all on the website. It's a great place to start.
Good. Thank you. Okay, as I do traditionally at the end of the program, I make sure that you guys get more of the last word than I do. I have to wrap things up at the end of the program, but I'd like you guys each to have a couple of minutes. Kathy, why don't we start with you? What have we not hit on, or what would you like to make sure people remember about CASA as we've talked about it?
Being the person who trains the new volunteers, I'm always recruiting. And so we're in a recruiting mode countywide, of course. We serve all of San Luis Obispo County, so it doesn't matter where you live. We would like to talk to you. We have a special initiative made possible by Must Charities up in the North County, a collaborative grant that's allowing us to do even more outreach and training up in the North County. About 40% of the kids live in the North County, so we are trying to keep our volunteer levels very high up there to meet that need. And so please contact us if you're at all interested and think you'd like to volunteer. They're on our website. You can find our information sessions. That's a great place to start, or just give us a call.
Okay, great. Pete.
You know, I really want people to know that this is an intervention for these children. The statistics on foster kids, kids that have been through this system, it can be pretty grim when you read it. And it's so much trauma has been involved, including the trauma of removing the child from their home, that the trauma carries through into their adult life and affects them for the rest of their life. And like I said, the single most important thing is a caring, committed adult in their life. And this is an intervention that can break this cycle for these kids, that can take them out of that statistical mess that they're facing. And it's something really exceptional that people can do. And I echo Kathy in saying that we're always looking for people that are going to be able to do that. And it's not something that everybody can do. But I do say that it's the best people in our community come out and do this, and that's the joy of my job is the people that I get to work with.
And tell me again, how many volunteers do you currently have?
We have 113 active volunteers right now. We have 125 active and available, so people that are waiting on cases. We're serving about 150 kids out of the 500 kids in the system. So we have quite a gap that we'd like to fill.
So if you could have a CASA volunteer for every one of those children, the court would be pleased with that.
And our community would be way better. Our community would be so better off.
As I listen to you talk about the program and getting involved in it, and I think about the fears that I might have of trying to become an effective volunteer for this, is there a way beyond going through the training, which is committing 30 hours beyond that? Is there a way that there's some preliminary information or some preliminary review that someone can do to kind of self-assess as to whether or not they think they'd be a good volunteer?
Well, I think coming to an information session is really a good place to start, and we do two a month. So if you look at our website, you can see where those are. One's always in our office the fourth Wednesday of the month at noon, and then we rotate through different Starbucks, so we reach different parts of the county. That's a great way to start. If you're not available for that, please just call me. Call our office. I'll talk to you or whoever's there and can give you more information, answer any questions. And there's a lot of information on the website as to what your role is, what you're doing, little videos, little stories. That's another great place to start.
Great. Thank you both. I appreciate it.
Fred, thank you.
We've been talking today with folks from court-appointed special advocates, Kathy Orton, who's the Resource Development Director for CASA of San Luis County, Pete Scarda, pardon me. Anyway, I'm going to do that. I apologize. As I've said before, I do it wrong all the time. Lead Advocate Supervisor with CASA, and we thank you very much for what you do with the program. This, of course, has been Central Coast Voices. I'm glad you've all been able to join us today. We are a project of Action for Healthy Communities, which is an arm of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. We put out a report called Vital Signs every 3 years. The next report will come out in December of this year. The last report came out in December of 2013, which will give you a snapshot of what's going on in San Luis Obispo County. You can see that whole report at www.actionslo.org. It's a report available for free. Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week, and she'll have great guests with her to talk about things going on in the county. As I've said, we're part of a collaboration with the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation. This program is underwritten through a grant from Jean Gellert Sargent, and we appreciate her support. And the Voices email address is voices@kcbx.org, which you are welcome to send your emails as feedback and suggestions for future programs, or give us a call at 805-543-2323. And thanks, of course, to KCBX Community listener-supported public radio, and we thank them for their support as part of this. Coming up next is my favorite program, This American Life with Ira Glass on Central Coast Public Radio KCBX. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us today.